Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thank you for hitting the download button on this very special edition of the WrestleTalk podcast, where Ollie Davis and I will be reviewing the Joker movie. And the reason why we're releasing this on the WrestleTalk podcast feed is because we have launched a brand new podcast. That's right, folks. If you didn't think we were giving you enough content, well, we have actually managed to do even more. We're now doing podcasts on a daily basis over on Screen Stalker, talking movie news and video game news. We're going to do video game reviews and movie reviews, and we're kicking all of that off with a review of the Joker movie, which is in cinemas now. You can go and check that out if you really, really want to. But without further ado, here is what Ollie and I thought of this. And remember, go and check out the Screen Stalker podcast. Just search for Screen Stalker in your podcast app of choice and download, subscribe, give it a rating and review. Help us get notice in that podcast feed. We really, really appreciate all you do. Support WrestleTalk, support Screen Stalker. Here's our review. Enjoy.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, and you in midair. Send in the clowns.
We are going to do a spoiler-free review of Joker for the first bit, where we're not going to give away anything that hasn't already been discussed in the trailers and whatnot. And then, oh, we're going hard. We're ruining the film. We're going to talk about all the stuff. We're breaking through the spoiler wall.
Spoiler barrier.
The spoiler barrier into the spoiler room brawl. And we're going to talk about when... Oh, you know what? Our go-to joke about any movie and spoilers is Batman shows up.
Yes.
I can't say that about this movie. He doesn't show up,
yeah,
by the way.
Spoilers, yeah, maybe.
But like, it's,
this
it
movie
make
that's
sense.
Set in the 1970s.
CM Punk returns. There you go. What a surprise that was. Right, so first off, just initial spoiler-free reactions to the film.
This is a 5-star performance in a 3-star movie.
Ooh.
I mean, that's my general overview of the movie.
It's Joaquin Phoenix's film, isn't it?
Joaquin Phoenix is incredible in this movie. This is one of those movies where you say, you get this a lot in sort of film criticism, where an actor falls into a role, sinks into a role, and just becomes that character. They're not an actor doing something. They are the character up on screen. They become that character. And Joaquin Phoenix becomes this character of Arthur Fleck.
Fleck.
This character of Arthur Fleck. He becomes this character of Arthur Fleck from start right the way through to end. He is that character. And it is mesmerizing at times.
It's what he's also done. It's not just an emotional performance through his facial expressions. So much of his performance is based on physicality.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to get pretentious here.
Please do.
So much of this film, this character, this performance, like, took me to Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, which is the story of a man who slowly starts to turn into a cockroach. It's a, you know, seminal book. It's a novella, so, you know, you can bust it out in a couple of hours.
I mean, you could have gone
my sex tape.
You could have gone with a more contemporary comparison, like Cronenberg's The Fly.
Yeah, well, you know, that's based off that. It's taken inspiration from it. But there's so many scenes, because he has lost a lot of weight in this movie.
He's done a full Christian Bale, speaking of Batman connections.
Yeah, right. And he's, you know, he's got his top off a lot just when he's in the house dancing around. when he's by himself, when I guess he can be free because he's away from society and he can live in this sort of imaginary world that he's constructed for himself, go into little flights of fancy, which I didn't see coming, to go off on a tangent. I thought this was going to be a very literal point A to point B telling of someone's breaking down, mm-hmm. like breaking down mental states. I didn't know it would actually be a much more subjective experience from the protagonist, in that you do get dream sequences. They are very subtle dream sequences, but they are inventions yeah. in his head.
Well, I would say that this movie is all told from his perspective, because yes. there is not a single scene that he is not in. And that, to me, suggests that a lot of the things that happen within the movie, you could always question, is this real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, etc., etc. And, you know, and he is trying to escape from reality, you know, to further that point. But I think you could argue that a lot of this movie is just his projection of what the world he wants to see is. I think a lot of it is really happening, but there's always that, but is it, or is it not? Or is it just all in his head?
And that's totally intentional. Like, it's a real subtle masterstroke, the way, like, how pared back they've made that. Like, you think of one, and we'll come onto it later, but the whole Fight Club style of mm-hmm. directing a movie, that is very flashy, and it's really auteur-driven, very stylistic. This is hearkening back to those 70s, 80s, downbeat New York thrillers.
This is Todd Phillips making a Martin Scorsese movie.
That's exactly what it is. And it leans on very heavily The King of Comedy
yep.
and Taxi Driver.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. He has essentially taken those as templates. Talk about Cronenberg using your metamorphosis analogy earlier. He has taken those as the template and has put DC into them.
Mm, yeah, and because like the first half hour of the movie, I'm just sitting back enjoying a very, very good thriller. Not thriller's the wrong word, but sort of character study.
Character study.
Yeah, yeah, and the performance. And then there's a bit where he's Arthur Fleck, is following a woman to Gotham Bank.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Gotham's there in big print on the side of the building. I was like, it's a comic book film. I'm watching a comic book movie.
And you forget that again until someone goes like, you should be in Arkham State. And you're like, oh yeah, it's a comic book film.
And to go back to what I was saying earlier, the physicality of his performance, that metamorphosis that he goes through, because it is like he is like popping his shoulders, his shoulder blades are really horribly poking out of his back. He's managing to... There's a scene, it's in the trailer, where all he's doing is stretching out the rubber soles of his clown boots.
Yeah.
But it's shot from behind him, and he looks like he's about to go American Werewolf in London. And there's even a line later on in a monologue that he does when he says about the people of Gotham City, the downtrodden, the poorer classes, as opposed to Thomas Wayne, you know, Batman's family, the Waynes, the rich elite class, how the lower classes are going to werewolf out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's that American Werewolf transformation is there, and he's in the way he's moving about and the way he dances around.
That dance, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I did want to, I think that dance, I was thinking about this while watching it, at Comic-Con's next year, there will be so many people doing that dance. Like, people are going to fall in love with this version of the Joker and will be doing that dance. In the same way that when you went to a Comic-Con in 2009, there were 20,000 people in Heath Ledger's Joker all doing the voice. Or like you went to one a couple of years ago and it's like, everyone's in Deadpool costumes doing a Deadpool voice.
I was doing Harley Quinn.
Harley Quinn's another one, yeah.
But yeah, it's all about this, someone who's very insular and like this at the start of the movie slowly emerges from their cocoon and becomes this horrible manifestation of Joker. And it's like this fully narcissistic, ego
murderous
driven
butterfly.
Yeah. It's like, ah! What a lovely butterfly. Oh my God!
Oh my God, he's got a gun! Yeah.
And it's just beautifully told. I when we came out of the movie and you say it's 5-star performance in a 3-star film, I think it's a 5-star performance in a 4-star film.
Okay.
So like, you know, yeah. We're not a million miles
it's apples
away.
And oranges.
Yeah. And we saw it with my lady partner as well. Luke crashed our double date.
Just a single date.
Yeah, it was a single date.
It would have been a really awkward double date if it was just me there.
And we all said the same thing, like, huh, that was, it's not a 5-star film.
I don't think so.
Like all of those reviews coming out of Venice were. And you know, festival circuits.
It's the festival hype, I guess. Yeah.
You'll get whipped up in a frenzy about how good something is. Don't believe the hype. But that's not to say this isn't an extraordinary movie, especially for the comic book genre.
I think it is. Those 5-star reviews are all based on his performance alone. I don't think it's... Maybe it's partly the direction, because I do think that Phillips, who was doing all he can to make everyone not like him by saying idiotic things in interviews, but he does really create this 70s style. Granted, I mean, it's lifted from other people's work, and he is just like copy, control C, control V into his surroundings. But I do think he shoots it very nicely. But I would argue that all of those 5-star reviews coming out of Venice were down to Phoenix's performance and his performance alone.
Yes. And then when you get the press screenings that came out this week and more of a general non-film critic crowd, that's when people are like, it's not what everyone said. But again, that's not to say it isn't an absolutely incredible film. I think I went in there with my own expectations. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I came out not, you know, oh, I didn't see the best film ever. I'm slightly disappointed. I didn't come out thinking like that. But I'm really excited to see the film again, to pick up on a lot of stuff that I must have missed, and also to go in there knowing what the film is.
So by the end of the movie, because, I mean, I was thinking, is this my favorite version of the Joker on screen? And I, at points at times, because he's so good in the role, I was like, this might be my favorite Joker, that I wanted to see more of it. So despite the fact I still think it is a 3-star movie, I do want to see more of his performance. I don't really want this to get a sequel, because I think this is a perfect one-shot comic book, and it should stay that way. But there's another part of me that's like, I really want to see more of that character. I want to see more of that character in the, because it's the most exciting Joker we've had in quite some time. Like, I want to see...
Jared Leto.
Well, less said about that, the better. You know, even DC don't want to touch that one anymore. Even they went, bit rubbish, really, wasn't it? Harley Quinn was good, though. Let's give her own movie. But I did want to see more of him. And actually, in a way, I want to see him fight Batman.
Yes.
Like, do you remember when we came out from seeing
Suicide
Squad?
We'll come on to that later.
Do you remember when we came out of Suicide Squad and we said, I do not want to see Batman fight that Joker?
Yes.
Because that isn't...
Yes.
Very well put. I want to see Batman fight this Joker. So bad.
Yeah, it's I really love this movie, but it's almost Okay, I'm not gonna say, because I need to think about it more. We literally just seen it.
Yeah.
But
oh yeah, like about an hour ago we left the cinema.
But initial reactions, like, let's just, for the sake of argument, put Joker alongside Batman Begins, which Batman Begins is my favorite Batman movie.
I'd go with that. Yeah.
And let's not get delved into what you think of Dark Knight and everything else.
I think it's very good. I think it's a very good 3-star film.
But what Dark Knight did is explore the character in a really fun way and had Joker there. Although I think Batman Begins is a better movie. Now that's what I want from Joker. Like, I've had my Joker Begins.
Yes.
I want, because it's 75-80% of this movie. God, even 85. Over 3/4 of this film is the very slow build, and it's brilliant, really well paced. I think you said you got a little bit bored.
It lost me a little way during the middle portion, yeah.
I thought it released information at a good pace, and I was always enraptured by the performance. But you don't get full Joker until, and I don't think that's a spoiler, until like the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, Rogue One, and Darth Vader comes in at the end, he's like, bam, 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 this is the Darth I've always wanted.
I want more of this Vader.
I know. And that's not to negate the rest of the movie. You need the rest of the movie to get to that enjoyment level. But I'm here, and this is great. I'm here wanting more, but there is that part in my head, do I need more?
That's it.
Like, is that just me saying, I want it.
That's totally it. We don't need another movie.
Yeah.
But I kind of want another movie.
Yeah, to leave audiences always wanting more, that's a hell of a legacy.
So we briefly discussed this upon leaving the cinema. We did stick around. I don't think there's also a spoiler to say there's no post-credit sequence to it. It's not that kind of movie.
There is a pre-credits sequence. I would say it ends on a cliffhanger, but we'll come on to that.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's interesting. We'll come on to that in the spoiler section. But so the question I wanted to pose to you was, if this movie is successful, and Warner Brothers are clearly hoping that it is a big success, they're hoping that it's going to get the Oscar buzz carrying over into March, April next year, and I'd imagine they're probably going to hope it's do well at the box office. Are they finally just going to say, do you know what, Matt Reeves, this Batman movie you've been working on for what feels like 10 years at this point, we're just not going to bother now. And instead, we're going to do a Batman sequel to this Joker movie instead, so we can capitalize on this popularity and title it Batman versus Joker.
That hopefully they don't call it that. I get for the point of the argument, that's a good way of putting it.
Because this Matt Reeves Batman movie has been just languishing for years. And I know they're starting to make a bit of headway with it because they've got Robert Pattinson involved as well to play Bruce Wayne and Batman. But could they essentially just like, let's throw out everything we've done previously and just start afresh, keep the cast you've got, and we'll just do this direction instead? Because DC aren't quite known for just changing plans on a whim.
Yeah, well, it's even got them further than our pats. You're talking to Jonah Hill, apparently, Jeffrey Wright as well to play Commissioner Gordon.
Great casting.
Amazing casting. Jonah Hill in a Batman villain role as well. So DC are stuck because they don't know what they're doing and they're just trying out different things and seeing what works. They've got the remnants of their previous extended universe, sort of scrapped some of the continuity, kept other bits, where weirdly Jared Leto's Joker is a part still. Harley Quinn in the Birds of Prey movie that interacts with stand-ins for that Joker, apparently. So you've got that stuff going on, and I think Matt Reeves' Batman will fit in with that. And I definitely believe there is a market, and it would be foolish business-wise not to at least attempt a DC version of what Marvel have just revolutionized cinema with. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say, at the same time, you can't also have this second imprint of DC films where you make more adult, non-connected movies.
That are going for that Oscar buzz.
Mm. And superheroes are our modern day mythology. So you can interpret them in so many different ways. You can have these very adult, realistic, gritty versions and the more fantastical comic book superhero versions too. The more I'm talking about it, the more I love Joker, you know. I think it's a very, very fascinating film.
And it's a bold movie as well. It is a bold movie to make in this very political climate that we live in, this very divisive, this sort of world divided that we're currently a part of. Mm. To release a movie like this and to make a movie like this, I think is actually quite bold and quite daring to just put this out there and be like, answer the question, like, ask yourself these questions. Because there are times where I'm like, this is holding up a black mirror to society.
Yeah.
Where we are glorifying the wrong types of people, or we are praising, or we are downtrodding this and the other. I just think that it is holding up mirrors being like, is this the world we want to create?
Mm.
And, you know, almost like in a Charlie Brooker style way to be like, is this the world? Is this how you want to see the world? Because there's every chance that we could see the world like this.
If you start to idolize these types of people.
The wrong type of people.
Really interestingly, you have had the opposite interpretation that I have had. No. But yours is totally valid as well. I do agree with what you said. So I was watching Joker and I was like, you know, he is a... The film never glorifies it, I would say. I never once thought, I want to be like Joker. I think he's a very sad... Very, very sad story at some points. And I empathized with him, but I never sympathized with him. You know, you sort of understand and see where he's come from, but it never justifies his actions, never explains it away. And that's very good. He's always framed as, this is absolutely disgusting what he's doing when he goes deeper and darker down those paths. But it is impossible, just like Heath Ledger's Joker, not to feel drawn to this level of anti-authority. And I think that's what a lot of the initial reviews might have mistaken Joker's character for when they started calling him an anti-hero.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because when people start calling him an anti-hero, it's like, lads, have we missed the point of the Joker here?
He's not a hero.
He is not. He is the bad guy.
He's very much a villain, but he is anti-authority. And a lot of the film has, and it's really well bubbled, same in a similar way how a lot of social unrest is in the background of Frank Miller's Dark Knight, and then it comes to the fore. That's what they do throughout this movie. You know that there's tensions between the upper classes and the lower classes in... Does America have classes? The rich and the poor. Rich and the poor.
It's the 99 and the 1.
It's a simplified version of the very intricate class system we've worked up over centuries.
Which we have worked very hard on.
Reginald D. Hunter's got a really funny line. He was like, you don't have racism in the... Well, we do, but he says, you don't have racism in the UK. You're too advanced for it. You just make fun of ginger people. But anyway, you've got that unrest happening. And that, I mean, fun fact, we're probably on the way to another recession. And all those like tensions between the rich and the poor are going to flare up a lot next year.
Way more than they did the last time we had a recession, yeah, exactly. 10 years ago.
So we can all feel that coming. I think as a worldwide culture. So to have Joker essentially start standing up to authority like that, you're like, oh, that's cool, and it's cool that like you've created everything's burning. Some people just want to watch the world burn. There's something quite cathartic in that, but also. You know, you keep it an arm's length.
Yes.
You are wrong.
Yeah,
you
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting because I think that this is a movie, and one of the things I actually really liked about this movie is that it opens up very interesting conversations, like the conversation we are having now, and you can kind of raise these points and ask these questions and sort of debate them amongst yourself. Although I do think there is the slight worry, and I think this is like the reactions coming out of the press screenings from Monday were in that sort of balance, like, I'm not sure there are people who are ready to have that conversation. They will just see this as, oh, he's right. Mm. He's absolutely right. We should just tear down the authority system and just start murdering people, and it's probably fine.
What, you think people are going to come out saying that?
Okay, so from a story perspective, a friend of mine went to go see it on Monday, and they were standing outside and having a chat with someone who also went to go see the film. And a person came up to them and said, have you got a cigarette? And neither of them smoked. They said, no. And he's like, okay. I mean, someone's going to kill you one day and that's fine. And just walked off.
But that's just it's a very nasty joke.
But okay, you say that person then, if he goes to see this movie, is he going to get the wrong idea of this movie? Is he not going to see that the movie quite clearly says he is a bad person?
Yeah, but you can't stop that. It's like saying, oh, let's scrap all the Marilyn Manson records.
No, I completely agree.
But it's an interesting discussion.
That's what I mean. It's an interesting discussion to be had around the movie. I'm not saying it's wrong either way. I actually think the movie does handle it very well. I had a bit of a worry about this movie going in that Todd Phillips was not going to understand that he's the bad guy and it was going to present him as the hero. I was almost thinking at times, is this going to be a bit like Rob Zombie's Halloween? I'd like to think this is going to be the only film show that compares Joker to Rob Zombie's Halloween remake.
Yeah.
In that Rob Zombie went too far into sort of like the Michael Myers backstory to be like, he was a little murderous child, but look how much of a dick his dad was. Like, look, his mum was lovely, but his sister was a right knob. You know, and so it almost like, that's why Michael killed people. He was justified in what he did. And so I was a bit worried that this might do the same thing with Joker, being like, yeah, he does kill people, but look what he had to deal with.
And it's a remarkable balance how they do it, because they do delve into his family history. And that's a large part of the character revelations in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of understand him more, but I never agree with him.
No.
Whereas, you know, sometimes when that tact is done, you do find yourself relating more to the person because of those explanations.
But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Finally finding the one that I wanted was yours. Making my entrance again with my usual flair, sure of my line.
Right, I don't think we can talk anymore without starting to spoil stuff.
Yeah.
I'm also conscious if people are just joining us from the WrestleTalk news as well. This is now the spoiler zone.
Yes.
We are going to start talking about spoilers. We've got 200 people watching right now. I'm hoping that everyone just goes away.
Yeah. Do you want to do a quick super chat?
Yeah, let's do some super chats in the middle. So we've got, just from DCF, one of the best origin story for one of the best villains.
I think they've already seen it. Yeah, I think Joker is one of the great comic book villains.
Yeah.
If not, like, the great comic book villain. He's certainly one of the most iconic comic book villains.
Yeah, I've never... can you think of any... Well, just in larger popular culture, any greater villains?
No. I can think... And it certainly helps the fact that he has been in a lot of movies, a lot of mainstream movies. You know, we've seen him in Batman 89, we've seen him in The Dark Knight, we've seen him in Suicide Squad, now we've seen him here. That's four movies, you know. That's more than most comic book villains have had. You know, he's had more goes at it than anyone else. And so I think that, yeah, he probably is the most recognizable comic book villain.
Have we had any solo movies for supervillains?
Venom.
Yeah, but he's a tweener. Let's just call him a tweener.
Well, he was a bad guy to start with.
He was very much a tweener in that film.
Yeah, I know, but that's probably one of the film's biggest errors.
Okay. But Joker is straight out the bad guy all the way through.
Let's make other bold claims on this. This was a better bad guy movie than Venom was.
Oh, yeah. I think most movies are better than Venom. Okay, so we're entering the spoiler zone.
Spoiler zone.
So let me see. You start talking about spoiler stuff, and I'm just going to flick through my notes.
There is a reveal in this movie that did have me going, uh-oh. I really hope that we are not going too far down this rabbit hole, which is his mum is very unwell. Mm. And she has been constantly writing letters to Thomas Wayne because she used to work for Thomas Wayne. And she keeps saying, we're in a really bad situation. My son's not well. He's on constant bits of medication. And Thomas Wayne is running for mayor and the city's falling apart. So she wants to keep writing these letters to Thomas Wayne to say, you need to help us. You need to save us. And I get the impression from the way that the film was framed that Arthur was never sending those letters. And he was just sort of like keeping them for himself. Not keeping them for himself, but he was just... Because he kept saying like, oh, he's not written back. It's like, yeah, no, I don't expect him to write back. Mm. So I got the impression that he was never sending them. But he does read one of them in which she says that Arthur is your son. And so Arthur now believes that Thomas Wayne is his dad. Did I say that right? I believe Thomas Wayne is his dad. Yeah. And that Thomas Wayne and his mother Penny had an affair, and they were trying to keep it under wraps. She had to sign lots of documentation, and that's when we had a couple of gasps in the audience. Where we were like, "Oh my God, he's Batman's brother!"
Oh, S word, half brother.
You know, all right, semantics. And then that was when we got the other gasp, which because he goes to Wayne Manor and sort of interacts with Bruce and. He says to this little
very young Bruce, a like very 10-year-old Bruce.
Yeah, 10-year-old Bruce. And he's kind of like, you know, sort of like playing with this little boy and he's sort of like doing some magic tricks for him. And then he says, what's your name, little boy? And he goes, Bruce. And the woman behind me went, no way.
Yeah.
And I was like, mate, keep up.
I heard like two people explaining that to each other. I was like, what needs to be explained? But that scene, again, like just the staging and the blocking of the movie is, it's, Fleck never gets through the gates.
Yeah.
He is always walled off from a certain part of society. There's always like a mask. I mean, the whole movie is about masks, the makeup that you wear to hide your inner self. And then for Fleck, the Joker is his real self. Just like Superman is the real Clark Kent. It's, yeah, it's like this reverse.
All right, Tarantino.
But the, yeah, that bit, I did quite like, because Fleck's there. And he suddenly feels like he's got a belonging. Suddenly everything makes sense to him. I am special. I'm the son of Thomas Wayne. He's running for mayor. This is my brother. I've got a brother. And he, like, he's lovely to Bruce.
I think it's more than just that as well. Because when he does eventually confront Thomas Wayne in that bathroom, he's not asking for money. What he's asking for is a hug.
Yeah.
He's asking for a father figure. A father figure that we later learn abused him as a child. The only father figure that he had in his life, because he was abandoned as a baby, and Penny adopted him.
Yeah, not Thomas.
No, not Thomas.
Not Thomas, no. Just his. Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, it's revealed that Penny also had paranoid delusions, and she made up the Thomas Wayne thing, and that's why she was fired from working for Thomas Wayne.
Yeah, so super spoiler territory now. After all that lovely, not lovely stuff, it's an awful movie, but like the bit where he feels like Arthur has some belonging in the world, like he might have some talent, he is special. And Pennyworth is in that scene. You assume it's Pennyworth. There's an English butler.
Yeah, I really appreciated. I think a lesser film would have said, that's Alfred.
Yes.
film would have had someone say, someone going, oh, Alfred. Alfred, yes. Pennyworth, the butler.
What did you say your name was, sir? Alfred. but they... I lost my train of thought.
Sorry,
I was thinking about,
apologize.
So she... Fleck then goes to the sort of Arkham State Hospital where his mother was institutionalized, and he's trying to find out whether she really was institutionalized and whether he really was adopted, like the Waynes say. Mm. And he a great scene, I think, when he manages to grab the...
Headbutts the screen to kind of like make him jump.
And he reads through, and it shows that his mother was... a delusional narcissist.
Yeah.
And you're like, what is more Joker than those two conditions?
Yeah. And he's delusional laughing and while reading this as well.
The laughter, by the way, we haven't gone on to it, is just a fascinating way of incorporating it into his character. It's a nervous tic.
Yeah.
It's essentially Tourette's. So he can't, in uncomfortable situations or when he's feeling emotionally distraught, he laughs. So you have these long, prolonged sequences or scenes where he should be feeling really, really sad, but he's laughing. But it seems like a painful experience. And you're like, laughter and crying aren't that far apart.
Yeah.
When you go for it. Like
there's that moment when he's doing his stand-up routine. Oh. And he just gets up and just starts laughing. But it's essentially like choking. He is choking on his own laughter.
Yeah.
It's quite wild, really. But it's also like... You almost want to see him like pick yourself up and do the routine, but he can't stop laughing.
And he does, but it's obviously a dream sequence.
Well, he does, because we do see that he does do at least two jokes. Like, yeah, he managed to pick himself back up, but in his mind, he nails
it. Slays.
Absolutely slays it. There's a certain amount of irony as well in Todd Phillips' comments recently about how, like, he can't do comedy anymore because he can't say anything these days, and this idiotic interview that he gave about a comedian that bombs and then decides to create a really violent world.
Yeah.
Because he made a lot of comedy movies that bombed and has now made a violent world.
But you get that revelation. So all that specialness of Fleck has been pulled from under his feet, and now he realizes not just that, but the reality is so much worse, where he was adopted. His mother went mad, effectively, thinking that she had mothered Thomas Wayne's illegitimate son when really he was adopted. And then she was in a string of abusive relationships with other men who would...
Abuse him. And she just watched.
And the report says that he was tied to the radiator, he was malnourished when social services found him.
Which then ties into that scene in the middle of the movie when he just takes all the stuff out of the fridge and goes and stands inside it, because you've got to imagine that must have been one of the punishments that he was given from one of his abusive stepfathers.
Just like hit me with a with a profound bomb. Yeah, that's quite something. But yeah, and like his mother always says, like, because she's very delusional, as the psychosis report says. There's a flash of her assessment, really, and they confront her with all these things, and she says, but he was always such a happy boy.
Mm.
And the way they filmed it is Fleck is in that scene watching over the assessor's shoulder at his mother saying it.
Yeah.
In this, so he's kind of imagining what's, but this is, it sounds like, oh, I'm having a dream sequence. It's never like that. It's like, it's just hard cuts.
Yeah.
There's no real cinematic language to show you that this is a dream. It's all left for you to figure out. And that's really mature.
Yeah.
It's a very mature movie.
Yeah, very, very mature. Mm. And one of the other things that people have said about this movie that I do disagree with is this idea that it is ultra-violent.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it is at all. It is disturbing.
Yeah, but it's not ultra-violent.
But the violence is all suggested, really. Like, there's one graphic kill in the movie, and it's all essentially off-screen.
Mm.
When he is smashing that guy's head against the wall, it is off, like, it's just him. You see his actions, but you do not see the bloodshed that comes from that. So you see the body, obviously, lying on the floor. But the way that some people have phrased this is like, oh my God, it's an ultra-violent movie. And really, it's quite tame. I'd say it's almost quite tame.
If you're just talking about amount of blood on the screen,
yeah,
and actual visceral depictions, what's actually shown, totally agree, it's not. But I guess that's why the way it's filmed is so good, that people can come away from that movie going, oh my God, what a violent film.
Absolutely right. I didn't consider it like that way, but yeah, you're right.
Because you know there's the thing about blood, where the human mind, the human memory will always think there's more blood than there was. Because it's like an evolutionary tactic to say, let's not do that again, because that made us bleed. So here I think people are going away thinking, wow, God, that it was just a movie full of violence. But in reality, there are two short bursts. One is slightly graphic, the other one is over in a second. And should we talk about that bit now?
Well, yeah, again, let's just, because I've just noticed there are more people who have joined us, we are in a spoiler territory section here.
Yes.
So we are very much in a spoiler review of this movie currently, if you are joining us from the WrestleTalk news. Do you want to read out that super chat that we've just got?
Oh, yes. So Total Blurred says, movie wasn't as bloody as the Quentin Tarantino movie. I said the exact same thing
you
to you.
You did. You said the exact same words.
The difference was, I didn't have to wait 2 hours, 35 minutes for the goriness of this one. So, yeah. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's 2 hours, 40 minutes long. You wait all that time and you get a little burst of violence at the end. And, you know, I didn't think it was... It was violent, sure, but I've seen more violent stuff. Everyone was like, oh my God, it's crazy. It's the most violent thing I've ever seen.
Did anyone not see the Fede Alvarez Evil Dead movie? Is everyone just raining blood sequence? Is everyone just forgotten?
Razor blades and eyeballs. But... Yeah, so you're right. This movie was nowhere near as bloody as that end bit of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But also, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood wasn't as bloody as a lot of other films as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even films in Tarantino's oeuvre,
yeah.
I would say. So, yes, I really want to talk about this because I thought it was the best scene in the film.
This is the final sequence.
The final sequence.
Completely agree.
And that's not, again, it's not to devalue the rest of the movie, because all of the stuff that comes beforehand is what puts the foundations in place for why this scene's so good. And it is Fleck finally getting booked on the talk show, let's just call him Robert De Niro.
Yeah,
it's played by Robert De Niro. The reason that's very important is because De Niro plays essentially the Fleck role, the delusional comedian in Martin Scorsese's King of Comedy from the 80s, where he kidnaps Jerry Lewis, who in turn plays the Robert De Niro role that we have here. And this is when Fleck completes his transformation into the Joker. So this is when we first... Well, it's not when we first see, but he's, you know, got full-on green hair.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the white face makeup.
He's got the suit on.
He looks fantastic.
Absolutely amazing.
We also get a bit of our boy Marc Maron. Yep, he's there as a showrunner. That's like two lines. Love him.
Absolutely love Marc. And credit to him. What a good agent. He managed to get in the credits.
Yeah.
And like a big name. He's not like an and. Or like, you know, he's not just in the list.
With Marc Maron.
future Stan Lee biopic star, Mark Maron. It's got to be.
But the just before he goes out, there's this beautiful shot of him behind the curtain. And this is when he really starts to do a slow dance. And
escaping from that cocoon.
And and it's just him completely finally realizing, out of the cocoon into Killer Clown Butterfly.
And further to that, what I really like about that shot is because he's just doing this dance. Early, just moments prior to this, there had been a big brutal attack on the train because Joker or Arthur Fleck killing these three Wayne Enterprise workers starts this sort of like uprising of people wearing clown masks and fighting against the establishment. And he's on a train, he's sort of like trying to hide amongst those while two cops are chasing him. And those rioters beat up and almost kill these two cops and put them in critical conditions in hospital.
Because a cop kills one of them.
Because a cop kills one of them by accident, So then when Robert De Niro is introducing him, he is saying, "We are all deeply moved by the tragic events that happened on the Gotham subway," and doing this very solemn thing and talking about how we're all deeply affected by it. And he's just there dancing, not a care in the world, because he's like, "Yep, I did that, and now I'm free. And this is who I am." And it's just a really wonderful juxtaposition.
And while you've got the whole movie of mostly downtrodden Fleck, but he shows these glimpses of, you know, full on psychotic Joker. It's as soon as he goes through those curtains. That's the end of the transformation.
The showman comes out.
And that's why we're both here being like, I want to see the sequel. I want to see more of this character. Because you only get 5-10 minutes.
10 minutes
of this
max.
Version.
Yeah, 10 minutes max.
And he just... But it's like, it was so thrilling to watch the Joker like this walk around. It's the Joker.
It is.
Like that. Everything before was Arthur Fleck. This is the Joker.
Yeah, and he even asks De Niro to introduce him as Joker. That is, Arthur Fleck is dead. Arthur Fleck is gone.
Mm.
He is now just the Joker.
Yeah, and he comes out and he's so confident the way he moves. He kisses
the female doctor.
An elderly female doctor on the lips for ages.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, like, you sometimes see those sorts of antics on chat shows. So it's like a supremely confident... It is like watching a real-life supervillain go and get an interview on a late-night talk show.
This felt like it was ripped straight from a Frank Miller... A Frank Miller comic book. Frank Miller Batman book. This sequence would have featured in this.
When the Joker convinced everyone he had reformed, he went round on all the late night talk
shows. That's why I was thinking about it.
And this is the first part of Dark Knight, because it's like a four-part... I think it's four parts overall. And he launches an attack on a late night talk show.
Yeah.
So, of course, you've got that parallel. You've got the King of Comedy parallels with De Niro, Scorsese and Fleck. What I don't think anyone's talked about, though, is Joaquin Phoenix's own uncomfortable experience on a late night talk show. I'm talking about the one with David Letterman when they did the movie with Casey Affleck. I can't remember the name of the movie. But it is. This was a year. Phoenix Letterman. Thrilling. Thrilling stuff. So, watch. Go and watch this YouTube link. I can't remember. What is the movie that he's talking about? Yeah, so Casey Affleck, Ben Affleck's brother. I'm Still Here, it's called. Made in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And this followed Joaquin Phoenix for a year.
The whole idea
was that... And it was a work. It was a good old-fashioned pro wrestling work. Unfortunately, a lot of sort of Me Too cases have come out since then about it. And, you know, the two guys' horrible behavior on set when they were in character like that justifies certain things. It was Joaquin Phoenix was going to quit acting and become a rapper.
Yeah.
And he did. Like, he went round, he did all the clubs, and then that would go viral and people would make fun of it on late-night talk shows. And it was all fabricated, though. Everyone bought into this. The climax of this, really, was him appearing on Letterman and just being completely non-responsive. And he was just chewing gum for ages, put it in Letterman's coffee. Apparently Letterman was in on it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just like that as well, when I was watching Phoenix here... Took me back to that interview as well.
That's very interesting. Yeah. It's a really, really great sequence, and it is the Joker's, you know, it is his coming out party, which actually kind of comes secondary, not secondary, but it kind of happens after, I'd say, the real coming out party for him, which is that the dance down the stairs. Because Phillips quite purposefully chooses a triggering song to add to the uncomfortableness of everything here. Because you are meant to feel uncomfortable watching this. He soundtracks him dancing to Gary Glitter. Gary Glitter, well-known paedophile.
Yeah, he's like king of the paedophiles.
He's king, yeah, king of pedos, Gary Glitter. Yeah. And it is his biggest song. And they are just like, and you are now going to watch this psychopath dance to a song. It might as well have been Time a Kangaroo Down by Rolf Harris. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, proper, like, to make you go like, ooh, yeah, oh no, no, this is quite uncomfortable, actually.
Well, it's a really smart move, though.
Oh, yeah, because it's, yeah.
What you're doing is you've got the Joker movie, which is making you uncomfortable because you're like, oh, I'm enjoying this movie, but it's all about all this stuff. And it's very similar to, unfortunately, a number of musical artists who have been since exposed as being paedophiles or doing other things, but your foot keeps tapping to that beat.
Because, yeah, I know.
So it's yeah.
I think it's actually a bit of a genius move.
And it's totally intentional.
Totally intentional.
Yeah, or any reviews you read where I disagree with this choice, it's like, you're being worked, brother.
That you're supposed to disagree with it. That's the point.
So, right, we have this really fantastic actual Joker end scene. And then he's arrested. He shoots Robert De Niro. Yep. And then everyone runs away. He's arrested. And then he's sort of broken out amongst all these riots, these clown riots. And in these riots, there's a shot of a cinema where Zorro is playing. And
really could have done without this.
You see the Waynes run out from the cinema because presumably the riots had spread inside. They go down a back alley.
Crime alley.
And then one of the, just a random protester, goes after the Waynes. And of course, we've seen this a gazillion times before. Shoots Thomas, shoots Martha.
What I thought was really nice about that,
the
though,
necklace.
Is he directly quotes Joker's interview, which is... It's the line, he has a line about Thomas Wayne, and it said, like, you get what you effing deserve, and before he shoots Bobby De Niro. And that's exactly the same thing that this guy in the clown mask says to Thomas Wayne and Martha Wayne. Martha, when he kills them. We said, and I totally agree with you here, because initially I was like, I really could have done without this. I've seen this, as you said, a gazillion times. All we needed was now showing Zorro.
Yeah.
And you as a
hinted
comic book,
it.
Hinted it. As a comic book fan, you will put two and two together and be like, oh, wow. And this leads to the death of the Waynes. But we didn't, I don't think we needed to see it. Although I did think that use of the line, quoting the Joker just moments prior, was actually quite good. It was really affecting.
And it also plays into the end scene, which we'll come on to in a bit. It was an interesting take on something that's essentially like a nativity play now. We've seen so many versions of... The murder of the Wayne family.
Yeah.
And it's always been, every version I've seen at least, has been Paul Wayne's. And, you know, this is still Paul Wayne's, but it's more like, oh, it was a act of indiscriminate violence of just because crime is widespread.
It was actually the Joker, is it, in Batman 89? Yeah.
But here, it was because the Wayne's sort of, like, Thomas Wayne and Martha Wayne are usually described of as these almost...
angelic-like characters.
Angelic figures, yeah, who can never be criticised. But here, it is their own recklessness and snobbery, and I'm not saying that justifies anything, but it's their rhetoric in politics, essentially, when Thomas Wayne is running for mayor, that creates this upswell against him, and unfortunately very violent, lethal ends. Mm. So I've never seen that take on, and I appreciated it being different, but that doesn't warrant it to make it so heavy-handed in the movie that is so subtle everywhere else.
That's it. I could have done without that sequence. And the only other thing I think I could have done without, as I said, because the movie I felt sort of sagged a little bit in the middle, the only other thing I think is mishandled in the movie and doesn't really work is the Zazie Beetz neighbor down the hall. Mostly because she's missing for a good portion of it. You get sort of like this sort of blossoming relationship between them for a couple of sequences. Then she's gone for a little bit, and then it's just like, and then he just goes back to see her again, and we find out they didn't have this relationship. It was all in his head. He did the Fight Club reveal.
Yes.
Like it was in his head the whole time, and I don't think it really worked.
Yeah, I agree. I think I like the idea of it.
Yes. Yeah.
And it did.
It's poorly executed.
It did work, but it could have worked so much better. If you're going to have that, I think you have to double down and really make everyone believe that she is falling for him. They are going out now. And then it's like, oh, but they're not.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I didn't see that coming. I saw this coming from the very first scene.
As soon as she was at his door,
yeah.
I was like, yeah, don't buy it.
It's a dream sequence.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's fine. That's like you've very effectively set up that we've got an unreliable narrator from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doubting these kind of things. That's very good storytelling. However, in this instance, I think a swerve would have been better than Hitchcock's ticking the suspense of the reveal.
Yeah.
But initially, I was like, oh, the Fight Club reveal was a bit heavy-handed because they do flashbacks of all the scenes that they've shared together and they have her in there and then they take her out. Initially, I was like, I knew that was the case anyway. However, now I'm thinking of it, it's actually quite a smart move because it's Arthur realizing this stuff.
Mm.
It's not meant for our benefit. It's Arthur going back and thinking, no, she wasn't.
I've made this all up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, he kills her. I mean, it's not explicitly said, but... Oh, he kills her. Yeah.
Well, that's the other, I think, yeah, in terms of sort of the poor execution, I like the subtlety of it.
Mm.
This is a film, you kind of hit the nail on the head for me. When we first came out of seeing this, when you were like, in a couple of days, I'm really going to reassess my feelings on this film. I might come away with a completely different viewpoint. There are times where I've been thinking like, yeah, no, I thought I was blah, 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 blah. But as I've been talking about it, I'm actually like, no, actually, I quite like the subtlety of that because the fact that we don't see him kill her is almost better. The fact that we just instead see him do the hand motion, I think is actually probably more powerful than the act itself. Him doing that and her going, uh-oh, I am in trouble, is far more effective than us seeing him do the action.
And the next scene is him in the living room and there's sirens outside.
Stuff, yeah.
I can figure it out. But okay, last bit, because this is the very final scene after the grand riot leading that he does. He's obviously locked up, he's institutionalized, he's in a completely white room, and he's talking to a psychiatrist who seems weirdly into him, you know, like, well, smiling and nodding.
I thought it was supposed to be, I don't know whether it's supposed to be his projection of it, but she looks exactly like the psychiatrist that he was talking to at the start that eventually said, I can't help you anymore.
Mm.
And whether or not we're supposed to think, or in his mind, he sees them as the same person.
Yeah.
He's getting his revenge finally on that person that stopped helping him and stopped giving him his medication.
Maybe. But he starts to laugh to himself and she says, oh, is anything funny? And he thinks back to the Waynes being shot.
Mm.
And he was like, oh,
You
wouldn't get it, which is a great line. There's so many great lines in this movie. You keep telling me not to have bad thoughts, but all I have are bad or negative thoughts,
yeah.
I think it is. I also wrote down the first line of the film. I'm obsessed with first lines of things now. And it's just, it's brilliant in terms of setting the scene, implying that stuff's going to come. It's a time of change. The opening line, after a lot of nonverbal stuff, I'd say it comes about 5 minutes in. Joker is in a psychiatry session and says, is it just me or is it getting crazier out there?
Mm.
What a great opening line,
yeah.
Especially for the Joker. But yeah, so he sees, he remembers the Waynes getting murdered. That makes him happy. He laughs.
Which he wouldn't have seen.
But, you know, in theory, he could have read about. He could have seen that on the news. I think that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough.
And then the next shot is him walking out of that room, still in an institution, quite clearly an asylum. And he's walking along, but one of his footprints is red. And then you're like, oh, that's a lot of blood on his foot.
Yeah.
And then, oh, you've got a little bit of red on you.
Yeah.
On you. And it's like, you know, it's brilliant because your mind fills in the blanks. I've just now got this really horrible visual of him stomping her head into the corner of the room.
What that final sequence really says, and I think it's indicative of the whole movie, is that Gotham has terrible security. Because not a security guard in sight for that poor woman. The Waynes had no Secret Service protection around them, considering he's supposed to be like running for mayor and is supposed to be the sort of high... Like, he had someone when they went to the play previously, when he went to the cinema previously.
Yeah.
And the police do a terrible job of tracking down the killer of those three innocent men who were shot down.
Gordon needs to get back in there.
Well, maybe this is the rise of Gordon. Yeah. He was there going like, come on, lads!
Simple police procedural work.
We have been doing terribly here. Of course there's an uprising. We essentially let them do it.
There was a guy in a clown mask. We found a clown agency. That guy was just fired the day of the murders for having a gun in a hospital.
A kid's hospital, no less.
Yeah, it's quite bad. Bad detective boy.
Anyway, gee, I wonder who did it.
He walks down. He does a little dance. It's all in kind of slow motion. There's discordant orchestral music over the top that's quite happy. And they have an almost Benny Hill bit where he runs away from a guard and runs the other way. So, are they setting up Joker versus Bruce?
Well, that's it, because that final shot of Bruce Wayne where he is just standing there over his dead parents may as well have had a bat fly past in terms of how unsubtle it was. I probably could have done without those shots.
Mm. But a really, really good movie overall. I've just got one more super chat to get to from Ryan Vasquez. Greetings from New York City.
Great city.
Are you guys ever coming to the other side of the pond? One day.
Yes, one day.
Hopefully soonish.
Mm, yeah.
It'd be great to see the American swafters.
Possible. Something possible this way may come. Sadly not in the New York area, though, which is I bloody loved.
Any more thoughts on Joker before we wrap up?
Speaking of New York, clearly Todd Phillips wanted to set this in New York, but was told that he had to set it in Gotham. And he was like, can I just make it New York, though? And
just rename Gotham.
And they went, oh, fine, whatever. Yeah. I'm sticking by my. I think it is a 5-star performance in a 4-star movie, but I wonder if that's going to be after a couple of days of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Currently, my initial reactions still are it is a 5-star performance in a 3-star movie, but Joaquin Phoenix is unbelievably great in this role, and it is, I still think it is, my favorite on-screen Joker. And I really didn't think anyone would do better than Jack Nicholson in terms of that, but I think he is going to end up being my favorite on-screen Joker.
I haven't got any more notes. I was just checking. I've got loads of things. Is Ace in the Hole anything? One of the clubs at the end was called Ace in the Hole.
Oh, right. Oh, so you
read
that. I
swear that's a Joker. What's that famous?
I mean,
there's the famous Batman cover with Joker holding Batman on an ace. I'm pretty sure there was some Royal Flush Gang graffiti in the lift. Deborah Kane was the name of the social worker at the start.
Oh, I missed that.
Kane is
Bob Kane.
Yeah, Bob Kane. And Barbara Kane is... Not Barbara Kane. Kane is the name. Carol Kane is Batwoman sometimes. So that's quite a...
Carol Kane?
Carol Kane, I'm pretty sure.
I was thinking it was Barbara Gordon. Oh, no, it's because I'm thinking of Batgirl, that's why.
Yeah, Batwoman.
Sorry, my bad.
But yes, overall, go and see the movie. It's fantastic. And of course, see the movie in cinema.
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune when I'm back on top in June. I said that's life.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.